Welcome to LOC, everybody. Today I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Rowan Williams, who is by no means your standard traditional establishment Archbishop of Canterbury. In 1985, while Dean of Clare College, Cambridge, he was arrested for scaling the fence and singing psalms at an American Air Force base in Norfolk on behalf of the Committee for Nuclear Disarmament. Having been appointed Archbishop in 2002, he went on to severely criticise both the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. More recently, as I'm sure you all know, he caused a bit of a stir with his lecture on civil and religious war in England, where, despite what the Daily Mail and Sun will have you believe, he argued simply that our legal system must keep an open mindset when considering how to adapt to change. Some mentions were made of Sharia law, but he went on to emphasise that the most important thing was not to put the rights our society considers as fundamental at risk. As you can probably tell, for him, politics and religion are greatly intertwined, and that can only be a good thing for the questions and debate today. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for the... Oh, there's always one. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for the introduction and the excavation of all the most embarrassing bits of my past. But you've been very helpful indeed in providing a few questions in advance. And what I'd like to do this morning is to take the questions that have been sent in and say a few words in response to those for a bit and see how much time we've got afterwards for more questions from the floor. And I hope it won't be terminally embarrassing if I ask the people who've submitted the questions just to wave their hands at me so that I know where they are and I can fix them with my eyes and hypnotize them into submission when I try to respond. The first question is from Robert Natzler. Hi. Who asks a nice, simple, direct question to start with. Why are you a Christian? This could obviously take the next 3 hours or so, but I'll try to be brief. I could answer it at least two levels. I could give you the plain descriptive answer, which is that I'm a Christian because I was brought up in a broadly Christian home in a broadly Christian country, that is Wales. But there's always more to it than that. And it was as a teenager that I started beginning to get a sense that the stories and the words that had been washing around over me since I was a small child might actually relate to my own experience and what there was to be hoped for. And I guess it was when I was about 14 or 15 that I really began to see that the big issues that I was at that time wrestling with, studying English, studying history, actually coalesced around the great ideas that my Christian faith was presenting to me. And those were things to do with what's the horizon for human beings? How big is a human being? Christian faith says that humanity is created in the image of God and that it can grow into a level of liberty, capacity to love, even capacity to change things that is really reflective of God. And that seemed to me then, and it seems to me now, one of the most ambitious accounts of what it's like to be human that you could possibly give. And I think it's quite a good idea to have an ambitious account of what human beings are capable of. And that gave me a real reason for believing it in the context of the story of creation and redemption. God wants us to be here. God thinks we're infinitely worthwhile. And therefore, the coming of God among us in the shape of Jesus confirms that dignity and liberty that belongs to human beings. And that all slotted together, as I say, with all kinds of questions that were coming up in my mind raised by the study of literature and politics and history. And I was very lucky that at that time I belonged to a Christian church locally whose members and whose clergy actually thought it was a good idea to encourage you to think in those large terms and encourage you to ask the questions. I'm still a Christian because I haven't yet found, and hope I never shall, any account of humanity or the universe that is half as persuasive or exciting as that is. And also because day by day, as I try to go on saying my prayers, the sense of not discovering new facts, but moving into new depths, goes on, supported by, nourished by, my Christian commitment and discipline of daily prayer. So not a very ideas-laden response in some ways. I can't say I'm a Christian because of X, Y, and Z, and this is why everybody ought to be a Christian. But that's how it came to make sense for me, and that's still the kind of sense it makes. Christian teaching gives me an excitement about humanity, all kinds of humanity. And it gives me a challenge at depth about how much risk I'm prepared to take for the sake of that humanity, how much I'm prepared to let go in terms of compassion or attention to others, which I am signally bad at, but I know is the way. That's I think where I'd start with it. So thanks, Robert, for giving that first turn to the wheel. And then there's Jackson Liu, hi, who asked me, who is my favorite philosopher and why? Am I allowed more than one? I'd quite like to have two, really. I'd quite like to have a few more, but the ones who've really shaped me are, I suppose, Wittgenstein and Hegel. Very, very different. Why do I like Wittgenstein? For those of you for whom Wittgenstein is not bedside reading every day, Wittgenstein, great 20th century Austrian figure, advancing two quite different accounts of what philosophy is for. Initially, suggesting that the point of philosophy was to clarify to, if you like, the minimal point, exactly how you would represent the world in words, knowing that when you'd done that representation, there was nothing more. That was it. You just had to shut up. And so the task of philosophy is just clarifying, reducing, mathematicalizing, you might say, the language. And then more and more he realized that that doesn't correspond to anything in the way language really works, or only a tiny bit of that. And he began to look at how the meaning of words is shaped by the way we use them. And the using of words happens in what he called a form of life, a practice, a way of going on, a way of relating, a way of shaping life together. And so he moves towards his second mature philosophy, which is all about meaning and use, and produces a series of blindingly difficult and complicated and unfinished reflections in his later years. But I just found him a deeply challenging writer in all sorts of ways, a philosopher who, as we know from his pupils, set the most demanding standards and would say to his students repeatedly, you've got to go the bloody hard way. Don't make philosophy easy. It's all about attending to the way things are said and the way people relate and the expectations around it, and it requires an immense focus on the particulars. He liked to quote a line from, I think it's Shakespeare's King Lear, I'll teach you differences. That attention to the different, to the specifics of forms of life. So, yeah, I got excited by Wittgenstein, learned from him, still love him, find him exasperating. And I came to Hegel later on, who seems in some ways to be the exact opposite. Somebody who believes that thinking about thinking shows you that everything finally folds in together. And yet, if you read Hegel, he's not saying, well, there's a quick answer and a universal system you can find like that. He says, it's by following out every single argument, pro and contra, again, in detail, watching the history of it, that you finally get to the point where you see how thinking is about convergence. Not in any glib or easy way. But it took me about 15 years of dipping in and out of Hegel to begin to see how he made sense. And I was very much helped by some colleagues and students of mine in seeing there was more to him than I'd thought. Those are the ones that really fire me, because I think in their different, wildly different ways, both of them say something which is actually said by John Gray, you know, from the LSE, in one of his recent books, Straw Dogs, which some of you may have read. He says, what if human beings were just put on Earth to see clearly? What if that were the human job? And I thought, well, yeah, actually, that rings a bell with both those philosophers. In their different ways, they're both saying our job is seeing. And the problem for human beings is the failure to see themselves, each other, to see and grasp what it is to be intelligent. Because the identification of exactly what intelligence means, look around you, I don't mean here, but look around you in the society we're in, and it's not absolutely obvious what people think intelligence is about these days. That's another story. Now here's a nice one from Francis Jean Rowe. In absentia. She asks, is agnosticism lazy? Well, I know some lazy agnostics, but I'm not sure that agnosticism is lazy. It's lazy if it simply means I can't be bothered to make up my mind. It's all too difficult. But I think for a lot of people who'd call themselves agnostics, there's a real sense that it would be dishonest, glib, cheating somehow, to come too quickly to massive cosmic conclusions. And I don't think that's lazy. I think it's honest as far as it goes. I think that at some point, everyone who would want to describe themselves as an agnostic is likely to come up against some situations in actual life, in thinking, where choices have to be made. But I think there's something healthy about the willingness not to be rushed into huge conclusions. And it's a bit related to a question from Louis Luntz, who asks about Richard Dawkins, surprise, surprise, who openly and directly attacks religious beliefs. Indeed he does. I've been on the receiving end once or twice. And Louis wants to know what my response is to the growing phenomenon of atheism. Well, let me talk first about the growing phenomenon of people reading Richard Dawkins. I suspect, that every age needs a kind of antipope. It needs an intellectual figure in public life asking awkward questions and pushing outrageous ideas. And Richard Dawkins is a great pusher in some ways of the most extreme, the most obnoxious and offensive versions of anti-religious language. And that he does it with such eloquence and even such charm is a great tribute to his intellectual quality. And I think part of his public reputation is to do with that sense that we need a figure like that in public. Bertrand Russell used to be the kind of poet laureate of atheism nationally, and now Richard Dawkins is, and in 50 years we'll have somebody else. Fine, that's public life. But more seriously, as to the arguments he puts and others with him, two or three points. First, Dawkins is, of course, a professional biologist geneticist. He would say that there is no way of holding the neo-Darwinian view of biology and genetics coming together and still believing in a purposive creator. To that, I think I can only say that there are plenty of other biologists and geneticists who don't seem to feel that problem so acutely. And the particular way in which he has developed the neo-Darwinian view is one which tends to reduce every single aspect of intellectual or spiritual life to Darwinian survival strategies. And I think that's both a reductive and a rather dangerous view of how intellectual life works. Not least because it cuts off the branch it itself is sitting on. If every intellectual system is a survival strategy in the Darwinian world, well, then so is Dawkins's version of Darwinism. So I don't think that'll quite do. Second thing to say about him, he's very, very reluctant to engage with forms of Christian thinking, or religious thinking generally, other than the most rock-bottom fundamentalist. And I don't know that he's actually read or digested very much of the tradition of serious Christian philosophy, historically or in the present. He would say, I think, and indeed does say sometimes, well, that's just clever Christians trying to wriggle out of the unacceptable consequences of what they believe. But I think if he or any other modern geneticist were held to the exact letter of what Darwin had said, they might be in some difficulties. Darwinianism is a tradition that has thought itself through and developed and grown and responded to challenge. And actually, so is Christianity, and so is any religious system. Third point, though, is most basic, perhaps. I don't think Christianity or any other religion is meant to be a scientific system. It's meant to be an account of the context in which the whole universe exists, the context of God. It doesn't set out first to explain things so that science comes in and says, well, we've got a better explanation. It sets out to give you a vision, an imagination, a commitment, rather than a set of explanations. So I think, and I've quoted this once or twice before, forgive me for repeating it, those who've heard me say it, it's something that Dostoevsky, in one of his novels, has one of his characters say, when he reads attacks on religion by atheists, it always seems to him that they're talking about something else, you know, not the religion he knows. And I guess a lot of people would feel like that with Richard Dawkins. So I'm fascinated by Dawkins, engaged by him. I don't worry too desperately about him. And I think there are plenty of very interesting responses. But the leverage he seems to have in public has quite a bit to do with what I call this expectation of a public anti-pope, and also with the status we now give to science. The assumption that if someone is a first-class scientist, they are automatically a first-class philosopher. Dawkins is clearly a first-class scientist. I don't think he's a first-class philosopher. But because we have this tremendously exalted view of what science is about, we think if you're good at that, you must be good at everything. And I think I want to put a bit of a question mark against that, with due respect to him. Here's a very challenging one from Edgar Smith. Asks, is it morally wrong not to doubt God's existence in the face of terrible suffering or moral evil like Iraq? That's a very searching one. I think I'd start by saying it's pretty odd not to doubt God's existence at some point in the face of awful sufferings. The most demanding interview I've ever had to do was with John Humphreys the morning after the Beslan massacre a couple of years ago, who essentially got me into the studio to say, well, you know, how can you talk about God in the face of this level of subhuman atrocity? And I said then, and I'd say now, it is very strange not to let that level of suffering and human awfulness dent something about your faith. But is it morally wrong not to doubt? I don't think I could say that. I'd say it is morally insensitive just to come out with untouched platitudes about belief in the face of that. But it does drive us, this sort of question, to very, very difficult level where I think I'd want to say, first of all, human atrocity makes me doubt humanity, at least as much as it makes me doubt God. And back to what I said at the beginning about how Christianity gives you, a big picture of what humans are capable of. This is one of the things that undermines that. Well, human beings can be like that. Are they worthwhile? Are they worthwhile in the way the Christian tradition says they are, if they're capable of such appalling cruelty? Barbarity. That's the level at which the doubt comes. And the other thing that I find myself driven back to constantly is when the question is asked, where is God in situations of horrible suffering? I remember saying about Bislan, well, God, if God is there at all, God is there in one child taking the hand of another to try and reduce their fear. God is there in any little movement that somehow witnesses to the dignity of humanity and the possibility of compassion in a circumstance where things are as bad as they could be. Somehow, when things are as bad as they could be, they are pulled back from being as bad as they could be by the extraordinary way in which human beings still do act as if compassion were worthwhile, as if human beings were worth taking trouble over. It's the encouragement given by one Jew to another on the way to the gas chambers. It's the texted messages of love to family and friends from people who are about to die in the planes on the 11th of September. It's those things which somehow bring back the human into focus. And for me, in doing that, say, well, talking about God is not such nonsense after all. If the world were uniformly dreadful and these things didn't happen, it would be a lot harder to believe in God. No quick answers to that. And, you know, I could go on, but that's where I'd start. Two questions here, related to each other, from Chris Sykes and Rebecca Kinder. Oh, hi. What's my view on hybrid animal-human embryos? And questions about whether Parliament ought to be reviewing the number of weeks before which an abortion is permitted, and about whether euthanasia should be legalised in this country. So a brief rundown of all the most controversial questions before our neighbours across the road. Hybrid animal-human embryos. Well, a slightly divided mind on this one. I'm not as sure as the Cardinal Archbishop of St. Andrews is about this. I'll tell you why. My general worry about the embryo research world is moving into a situation where we take it for granted that it's all right to create embryos solely for the purpose of research and then destroy them. I think that's the moral difficulty. And actually, it's shared by a number of people in the world of embryo research that I've spoken with. If they could find other ways, they would. But that's where I would want to raise a real question in general. Now, the animal-human embryo. My question, and I'm not enough of a scientist to resolve it, my question is this. If you were creating a real embryo, that is something which could actually be implanted and grown into a hybrid organism, then I would be worried. I would think, I don't know what we're doing here. If you're creating a purely laboratory reality, which has certain features of an embryo about it, which allow you to experiment, I don't think the problem is quite the same. Most of the scientists I speak to who've got experience in this field say the so-called cybrid, the laboratory construct, is almost certainly not capable of being implanted or grown. It remains a pure laboratory reality. If that's the case, I have fewer moral worries, though I still have some. So that's my very cautious view at the moment. I'm still trying to find out more about it and spent a rather head-banging day a couple of weeks ago at a day conference in the University of Christchurch, Canterbury, trying to understand a bit more about genetics to shape my thoughts about this. As for abortion, euthanasia, I think, briefly, that yes, it is time to reduce the number of weeks. I think that, apart from general questions about abortion, on which I have a fairly traditional and rather absolutist view, okay, granted, it's legal, and therefore we have to work with that. But as the technology moves on and it becomes easier to save, continue the life of the embryo stroke fetus after a shorter and shorter period in the womb, I think we do have to look at that very seriously. I would like to see that level reduced. And on euthanasia, well, again, I would take a fairly straight view on the admissibility, the moral admissibility of euthanasia. I'm not happy with it because I believe that our lives are given us in trust by God and not to be returned at our own choice. And B, I think that as soon as we legalize it, we open the door to pressures, psychological and economic, around accelerating death, which could be deeply difficult, very problematic. These are arguments which I and others have had, again, across the road in Parliament, and the argument goes on. A clarification, though, I certainly don't think that the church, whatever people mean by that, ought to be able to dictate what Parliament does or what the nation does. But I do believe the church has a right and a duty to get into the argument and try and persuade people. Not everybody will agree with what I say about euthanasia. Not everybody begins where I begin, with a particular moral and religious view. Okay, so I've got to argue. I've got to try and persuade. And that's the job of public debate in a sensible society. So I'm not asking for the liberty of the church to decide policy. Vivian Ullmann asked exactly that question. To what extent do you think religion should influence the laws of the state in this age? And I hope that's part of an answer. Influence in the sense of being involved in the argument. Determining the outcome, we're not an autocracy where archbishops decide things. Not even the church is like that. That's another story as well. Isabel Faulkner asks, why are there no female bishops in the Church of England, and will this change? Why are there no female bishops in the Church of England? Well, and the short answer is, of course, we've never had them. And we are in the middle of debating whether we should. Historically, partly because of theological convictions, partly because of social conventions, women have not been seen as being eligible for the same role as men in the church as in other areas of society. As that's changed in society at large, the questions come for the church. Is our resistance to women clergy a matter of social convention, or is it really a matter of religious conviction? And if it's a matter of religious conviction, what kind of conviction? And that's been what the arguments dealt with over women priests and now over women bishops. As we speak, there's a report being prepared which the Church's Parliament will be looking at in a couple of months' time, and the bishops of the Church of England are finalising, trying, as I say, to sort out whether there are deep theological objections or whether the objections can be overcome, and also trying to sort out what weight in that discussion should be given to our relations with other churches like the Roman Catholics, the Eastern churches. So, work in progress, I think, is the answer there. The reasons that have normally been brought up against women being priests and bishops have to do partly with history, Jesus's male apostles, partly with theories and speculations about God's different purposes for the different sexes, a number of other things like that. But why don't we have them? Because that debate isn't over yet, I think is the short answer, and it continues. Now, Arjav Trivedi, hello, wants to know whether I believe that Britain is becoming a disillusioned and divided country. Yes, is the unhappy answer. Disillusion's a very interesting word there, because I think there is a level of public cynicism in our culture and society, which is a bit worrying. We want very promptly, very, very quickly and decisively to undermine anything that looks like a credible ideal or a public figure who wants to talk idealistically, and you can sense the almost the sigh of relief when someone in public life finally makes the mistake that allows you to go for them. Gordon Brown's had it a couple of times in the last 12 months, as you've noticed, and he's going through it at the moment. Coming in on a wave of, you know, sober, principled, responsible reputation. Oh, wonderful, at last we've found something, say, the media-related public. We found something that we can use to dissolve that. So there is a cynicism around, which is not good for us, I think. And I'm not suggesting we go back to a kind of uncritical view of public figures where they can do no wrong, God forbid. But getting the balance between a responsible, critical society where people are encouraged to ask really awkward questions and a society where everyone assumes the worst in public life and loses trust in politics, that's grim. And I think, and I don't, you all know better, but my sense is that people, say, of my daughter's generation, not so far from yours, find politics, as traditionally conceived, a very uninspiring world, to put it mildly, and not one that many people want to get stuck into. That's disillusion. And I think that leaves a lot of the divisions, racial divisions, class divisions, that we ought to be thinking through, not very well addressed in public. So, yeah, I've got some sympathy. Patrick Beardmore, having tested the waters on Sharia law, do you still believe its incorporation into UK law is inevitable? Well, indeed. Thank you for your gloss introducing me, which is very helpful. Testing the waters is a very fair way of putting it, I think. I asked the question whether, given the way that we thought about our culture these days, whether there could and should be ways of bringing elements of Islamic law into the field of recognition of British law. And coincidentally, just a couple of days after the great fuss about my speech in the Royal Courts of Justice, the government announced that it was introducing some Sharia-compliant forms of mortgage arrangement for Muslims in this country. And my immediate thought was, yeah, well, there you are. That's just it. That's the point. That's the kind of thing. And the word inevitable, which wasn't a very happy choice of words, I think was my own way of saying, if we're going to live constructively and harmoniously with people who have some very different convictions about certain things, like money and interest, we need to ask whether our law can cope with that. And I think if we really want harmony and constructive relation, then it's inevitable that we should ask those questions and perhaps recognize those differences. The mortgage compliance thing is absolutely the sort of thing I was talking about. And the much more difficult area of domestic law and the role of women, that creates, as I said in the lecture, some tougher questions, but ones that we can't really avoid forever. And I seem to remember the word inevitable means unavoidable. And so we can't get away from those issues. I still think that. Very interesting question again from Hannah Hauer King. Do you think we are psychologically programmed to believe in God? Depends whether you think we're psychologically programmed to believe in anything. And it's back to the Dawkins question. Is our thinking life, our thinking, feeling, imagining life, just a kind of spare time activity of a mechanism going on inside us? Or does it have a real independence? I think to say that any belief is programmed or genetically determined or whatever, I'd be very reluctant to come to that conclusion about any imaginative intellectual vision, because it does seem to me to reduce our humanity again. But the other side of the question is, are we in some sense so constructed that we become a bit less than human, a bit less than normal, you might say, without belief in God? That's a much more interesting question, relating to a really sharp question from an unnamed religious studies pupil. Is it true, as St. Irenaeus says, that only God can satisfy us? And as a Christian, I would say yes. God is what we're made for. We are most human when we're most in touch with God. Most human, most capable of intelligence, love, liberty, relationship, when we're most in touch with God, the source of all love and freedom and relationship. And is that psychological programming? I don't think so. I'd call it more creative purpose, I suppose. But the teasing out of how the image of God, that the picture of God in our minds, is formed by our psychological evolution, how it interacts with internal images of parental figures and so on, that's a very interesting area, which a number of scholars have worked on, I think very, very usefully, without at all concluding that because we can find analogues between these relationships, then we just dismiss the whole idea of God as being really there. But it's related to a question from Flora Zakon. Hello, Flora. What would I say to those who suggest religion is only a comfort blanket, or, as Freud said, a kind of neurosis? How would I hope to refute these claims in the absence of unquestionable evidence? First of all, religion is a comfort blanket. I think I could only answer that by pointing to the way in which religion actually specifically works in the lives of a lot of people. Plenty of people use religion as a comfort blanket, as a shortcut, to make themselves feel good. And then you have to give an account of those who somehow don't. I mean, I don't have the impression that religion is a comfort blanket for Archbishop Tutu, let's say, or that it was a comfort blanket for Martin Luther King. These are people who regard their religious faith as something prompting them to take some rather large risks, and risks for the sake of those others whom they believe God cares about. So whatever you say about religious faith in that context, comfort blanket, I think, won't do. They may be deluded, if you like, but the one thing they're not out to get is an easy life. Years ago, debating with Don Cupid, the religious philosopher in Cambridge, when we were colleagues, and he was always going on about how religion was generated by the will, you know, internally, and nothing to do with anything out there. And I remember saying, you know, if you'd gone up to Martin Luther King on the eve of his assassination, or Thomas More on the day of his execution, and said to them, "Do you think what you believe has anything to do with what's really the case?" Then Moore and Martin Luther King might very well have turned round and said, with varying degrees of impatience, "What the hell does it look like? You know, here I am being executed, here I am taking risks. Come on, you know, this must be something to do with more than me." So, not an argument, but just an observation, a sort of Wittgenstein observation. What's going on? What's the language doing? Neurosis is much harder, of course, because it's very tempting to characterize almost any belief that you think is irrational or inadequately evidenced as neurotic. And Freud's own way into this was, of course, to treat religion as an obsessive compulsive neurosis, a very particular kind of neurosis. And I'd want to see what the specifics are before giving a general answer. I think Freud's account of religion as obsessive compulsive behavior is vulnerable on any number of scores, just again as a matter of description. So I'd want to argue that on the basis of what it looks like and say religious belief may be true or false, but I don't think it's to be too readily dismissed on the grounds that it just serves this or that psychological purpose, partly because of the sheer variety of how religious people behave. Sorry, time's marching on. I'll try and deal with the remainder, if that's all right. Briefly as I can, so we might just have one or two extras. Two related ones, Jake Mellett and Milan Vada. Hi. To what extent do you think one has the right to convert people to the Christian faith, and will those who are faithful believers in other religions go to hell for their beliefs? Jake, to what extent do you think one has the right to convert people to the Christian faith? Trouble with the way that's phrased, sorry, no criticism, but you know, it's the language that might carry the wrong answer. It suggests that conversion is something I do to other people. When someone converts, they change their mind. I have absolutely no right to make anyone change their mind, nor has anyone else. I do have the right to argue with someone and try and persuade them and hope to persuade them. And I think that society has the duty to safeguard the right to change your mind. So does one have the right to convert people? If that means does one have the right to make people become Christians? No. If it means does one have the right to try to persuade? Yes. And then you're into the sort of ethical questions of what right and wrong ways of persuading look like. And there are manipulative and false and silly ways of trying to persuade which ought to be ruled out of court. And there is the honest, persistent, respectful argument that I hope we can all engage in. And will those who are faithful believers in other religions go to hell for their beliefs? I think believers in other religions would go to hell for exactly the same reason that you and I would go to hell. That's to say, by the willful refusal of life and hope. One of the great Christian principles is that nobody goes to hell except by their own choice. And I'm using going to hell as a kind of shorthand for being somehow cut off from the life and love of God. We go to hell from our own choice because, mysteriously, we've made ourselves so selfish and so stupid by our own choices that we're no longer really capable of seeing goodness when it hits us on the nose. And that's the paradox of hell, and in Christian teaching, almost the absurdity of it. The devil, again I'm using shorthand, but the devil is not a vastly cunning, supremely intelligent, subtle being. The devil is, in one sense, the most stupid being you can imagine, in that the devil, as imagined in Christian history, is an angel who has seen the glory of God and said, nah, that's stupid. And going to hell is like that. You cut yourself off from life because you say, I'm not interested in life. That's why people go to hell, not because they believe this or that set of propositions. Now, it raises the question, what's the relationship between other beliefs and Christianity? I believe, and that's why I'm here in this job, you know, I believe that the Christian faith is true. That is, it gives the most comprehensive and exciting and life-giving version of reality that is available to human beings. That's what I want to grow up in, that's what I want to live and die in. And that means that when I look at other faiths, I can't relate to them in the same way. But I can find all kinds of echoes, points of contact, points where I want to discuss and engage, and I do quite a bit of that, again, professionally, through interfaith dialogue. And I don't try and make God's decisions for him. But whether in the Christian family or outside it, going to hell, that is, final loss of life, meaning, would only come if someone seeing the truth fully wanted to turn away from it. And two more very briefly, which are all the ones I've got here. Why does Jesus like using paradox in his teaching? Another one from a religious studies pupil. Very good question. And I think it's because Jesus in his teaching is constantly trying to get people to start from another point than the one they take for granted. He's trying to make it strange. He's dealing with a religious environment in which people think they know all the answers, and so he uses paradox and irony and sometimes shocking things to get people to another point. It's about the newness of the world, and paradox does that for us, doesn't it? Just one example which has stuck with me, and it's the parable of the Good Samaritan. Not exactly a paradox, but a shocking thing. Jesus begins to tell a story about a priest and a Levite, and in the context of his time, that was rather like beginning a story about an Englishman, an Irishman, and a Scotsman. You tell stories about a priest, a Levite, and an Israelite, the three levels of society. There was a priest who came down the road, and he walked by on the other side. There was a Levite who came down the road, and he walked by on the other side. And there was a... And the audience is waiting for an Israelite. They want to be told that the hero of this story is a good, ordinary, down-to-earth Israelite bloke like themselves, not some stuck-up priest or Levite. That's what they're expecting, and Jesus says, and a Samaritan came down the road, which completely ruins the story. It's not what they're expecting. Instead of the hero being the good, ordinary, solid, honest-to-goodness bloke, it's the person you would least like to go on a train journey with. It's the person you are most encouraged to despise. So instead of the Englishman, the Irishman, and the Scotsman, it's the Englishman, the Irishman, and, well, fill in the gaps, who are the people we least like to be alongside these days. It's the Englishman, the Irishman, and the asylum seeker, the Englishman, the Irishman, you know, fill it in. But that's what's going on there. And the last question, sorry, rushing here. The most difficult of all, what is the secret of holiness? How should we live if we want to be holy? Taking a leaf out of my master's book and being paradoxical, I would say, how should we live if we want to be holy? By not thinking about it. By not even asking the question. Because holiness is in part unself-consciousness. It's being so absorbed in the reality of God that you're not wasting time thinking, am I being holy? And the awful thing, of course, is you can't do that by trying. You can't say, right, today I'm not going to think about being holy, I'm going to think about God, because that's the way I'm going to be holy. No, damn, I thought about being holy. And so on and so on. We've just got to let ourselves somehow be overtaken by God's surprisingness and God's glory. And that's how holiness happens. It happens when we're not looking. One great early Christian teacher said, you're really praying when you don't realize you're praying. And that's worth thinking about. And holiness then becomes just that being unself-consciously at home with God in such a way that something of God comes through. And that's why holiness is different from just goodness. Again, someone once said, good people can make you really depressed because you think, oh, dear, why aren't I like that? Good people go around with a sort of glow and you think, I can't manage that. Holy people make you feel better than you are because they convey something of God, something of love, acceptance, and promise. That's the difference. But the awful truth is it doesn't come by trying to be holy. Just comes by God being real. And there are things you can do about that, like being quiet with him and making sure you go on absorbing the Gospels day by day and doing those ordinary duties towards one another, which our vision of humanity, back to where I started, sort of compels you to do. So there we are. That's the questions. And I've run over time. Sorry.
We don't often hear from pro-religious sources, so that's certainly refreshing in itself. And in particular, I found the response to Dawkins, the reason for him being Christian, and also the small philosophy lesson very interesting. You mentioned that the media turns into this sort of predator, which you yourself have been on the receiving end of. And I know that a lot of people, including myself, respect you for standing by your principles and convictions when in the face of this, and I think you showed them to a great extent today as well, so it really was a pleasure. Thank you.